Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here on Marketplace Money, we have a feature called the Buzzword, where we define the jargon bandied about in the world of business and finance. Well, today's show is going to be full of unfamiliar words, like, for instance, 你好, 我是李开先生. That means, hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, in the language of the country our show is broadcasting from today. To repeat, 你好, 我是李开先生. Now here's a quiz. What language am I speaking? Is it A, Vietnamese? Today's show is live from Vietnam, a war zone turned financial success story. Or is it B, Korean? We are coming at you from South Korea, the world's most wired country. Or is the language C, Mandarin Chinese? We're here in China because it's set to become the biggest economy on earth. Not sure? 别担心, don't worry. The answer's on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We'll be right back. I'm coming to you today from the lobby of the Astor House Hotel. We are just off the Bund, that's Shanghai's riverfront, and we are here to take you on a tour of the Chinese economy, how it's changing, and what those changes are going to mean for you. Zai Zhongguo, Shanghai. Live from Shanghai, China, this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, serving Lutherans, their families, and communities by helping them achieve financial security and give back to their communities and congregations, offering a wide range of financial products and services. Thrivent.com. Marketplace China reports are supported by Best Buy, building a global network to help enrich lives through technology, innovation, and opportunity. Best Buy.
For first-time travelers to China, it is amazing how completely alien and, at the same time, totally familiar this place can be. America has Starbucks everywhere, so does Shanghai. America has personal finance shows, like this one. China has Yuan Jing and her financial hotline. In Chinese, personal finance is Guren, personal, Li Cai, finance. And here's what it sounds like.
2006年每周一至周五上午11点 FM 97.7 AM 1422袁景理财专线全新登场。
Yuan Jing's financial hotline airs on the China Business Network here in Shanghai. It is no Marketplace Money. We've got our economics editor Chris Farrell after all, and they don't. But there are some familiar elements. Yuan Jing is the host of the program.
比如说他们会觉得我可能每个月工资拿来之后我。
A lot of the audience calls and says, we are these workers, we've spent our monthly salary, and we don't have enough money left for investing. This program tries to tell people that investing isn't only for rich people.
She takes her job very seriously.
We have a slogan on the show. Organizing your financial system is as important as your breathing system.
Not exactly how we'd put it on Marketplace Money, but the principles are the same. Saving, investing, and paying off debt. Having money at all is a new thing for the Chinese. In fact, per capita income here has increased fourfold since 1980. So essentially overnight, people have gained access to the ups, but also to the downs of having money. And often, Yuan Jing finds herself telling listeners how to avoid personal finance pitfalls, things we in America know all too well. Like credit card debt, relatively new to most Chinese.
举个例子就是我们生活当中的这个去消费，消费很多年轻人。
We are trying to tell our audience how to control their money and how to spend their money on necessary things. Young people like shopping; they don't have to buy everything. There are a lot of issues with credit cards now, and we are trying to teach our audience how to balance it.
信用卡的使用让大家觉得非常方便，但事实上给自己。
On the day we met her, Yuan Jing had been talking insurance, apparently as much a mystery in China as in the U.S.
比如说我们在现在确实很多我们的这边一些消费者一些保护他们。
The audience didn't know a lot about the products they bought.
不太清楚他究竟是买了些什么内容。
Money is the same everywhere, whether you call it a dollar, a yen, a buck, or a pound, but how we think about it isn't.
Sometimes in the States, people get embarrassed when they talk about money. Or they are 不好意思，你知道。Same thing here. Are Chinese people embarrassed to talk about money? Do they not like to talk about money?
好像在一些传统的一些观念当中，好像是不谈钱。但是呢，
Traditionally, people don't talk about money. But now we are not embarrassed to talk about it because making money isn't a bad thing anymore.
For Chinese New Year, at the end of this month, Yuan Jing is planning a special show about what people would do if they had a fortune. I asked her about her dream. The answer was typically Chinese.
我的呢
I want my audience to gain more fortune, and their fortune will be my fortune.
After we talk, I take a quick tour of her cubicle. I have a window in my office, but she has two teddy bears and a teddy bear cell phone holder. We walk down to the studios on the second floor of the Shanghai Media Group Tower, and there, we're stopped by an armed guard. And that's when I discover the real difference between Marketplace Money and Yuan Jing's show. We don't share our offices with a local Communist Party secretary. are all about keeping you, our faithful listeners, financially literate. So when someone throws business speak at you, you have some idea of what they're saying, even if that business speak is as clear as Chinese. I mean, literally here, Chinese. With China's economic star on the rise, being able to speak that language could be key to financial success. And parents are making sure their kids don't get left behind. Diantha Parker reports.
This fifth grade class at Chicago's Louisa May Alcott Elementary School is learning to talk about matters of great interest to them in Chinese. Their teacher, Hung Wei Yu, holds up a realistic looking plastic hamburger and picks from the forest of hands.
Okay, wa shi ji han bao bao.
Oh, do you want to say wa shi han bao bao?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yu stresses the importance of tones in Chinese. This kid almost used the wrong tone. Instead of saying, I eat hamburgers, he nearly said, I am a hamburger. Chicago's Chinese Connection Program is the largest Chinese language program in any public school district in the United States.
你好,你好,我是米亚内,我是马姐。
The idea is that these fifth graders can continue to study Chinese through 12th grade. The program is in 20 schools and counting, with 3,000 K-12 students enrolled. China has an investment in Chicago as well. The Ministry of Education gave the Chicago Public Schools 1,000 textbooks last year and plans to keep contributing materials. Other cities across the U.S. have launched Chinese language programs, including Houston, Philadelphia, and Charlotte, North Carolina. In all, that's about 50,000 students. That sounds like a lot, but not when you know how many Chinese are studying English. Alcott principal David Domovic adopted the program after going to China last year with a group of local principals and was blown away by the students he met there.
How motivated they were, how energetic they were in within their own language and culture, and also speaking English and welcoming us and explaining things about what they do.
Nearly every third grader in China can have a rudimentary conversation in English. In a country of 1.3 billion, that's a lot of English speakers.
It made me realize that, we need to be broader at our school.
Domovic says parents lobbied for the program, too.
I think they know the importance of how business is going to China and companies are outsourcing to China. And I think they feel that when their children become adults, they'll have a heads up and the business world if they speak some of the language and certainly know about the culture.
The fifth graders at Alcott Elementary aren't concerned with acing job interviews just yet. For now, they're having fun expressing themselves in another language. Many already speak a second one at home. For Yelena Minichinin and her family, that's Serbian, as she's about to tell you. But once these Mandarin-speaking children grow up and start looking for jobs, they'll have a lot of opportunities. Plenty of locally-based multinational corporations are heavily invested in China and need Americans who speak the language, including Motorola, Boeing, and United Airlines. But Chicago's Chinese program is also about cultural understanding. Kids show respect toward each other and their elders the Chinese way. They bow to one another and to Ms. Yu at the start of every class. They're also proud they're learning one of the world's most difficult languages. Experts say it can take up to 1,500 hours for an average English speaker to learn Chinese, compared to 500 or so hours required for French or Spanish. Educators and economists say that'll be time well spent. In Chicago, I'm Diantha Parker for Marketplace Money.
For special web-only features and photos from our trip to China, you can check our website. It's marketplace.org. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This isn't my first trip to China. Back in the 90s, I lived in Beijing for a couple of years. And one of the big things I noticed when I came back to do the show this time is how many more American companies are here. But even now, both for companies and individual investors, China is still risky business. Jim McGregor's book is called 1 Billion Customers.
If you're looking to make money off China, use your speculative money, because the Chinese stocks that are listed overseas bounce up and down at the whims of the hedge fund or the political ups and downs of the relationship, and they often don't reflect the underlying company and the company's prospects, so they swing wildly. So if you want to make money off China, you better look at it as speculation and watch the trends on when they're up and down and buy when they're low. It's not a game for widows and orphans. It's a game for investors that have money and have a global outlook and are willing to lose a little as well as make a little.
The thing we hear about China all the time is that it is spending all its money to buy U.S. debt. It holds hundreds of millions of dollars in treasury notes and treasury bonds. That obviously is driving down interest rates here in this country. Otherwise, though, is it a good thing or a bad thing?
China buying all this has helped because it's kept down interest rates and has helped the housing boom going. On the other side, China producing ever cheaper products for Walmart has helped keep the spending power of the eroding blue-collar class in America high because they've been able to buy things cheaper and cheaper.
One of the things that really affects us here in this country, I think, in terms of the Chinese economy is its growth rate and its demand. It is hugely consuming oil and other commodities. Is that driving prices up for us?
China's become like America. They're a voracious global consumer of natural resources. So that, yes, will make them a competitor with us, but such is life. Another country's emerging.
Do you think China has too much influence and leverage over the American economy on two levels, the macroeconomic buying T-bills level, and then the very microeconomic, you know, what it's doing for the American consumer and what he pays level?
Well, I don't know how much is too much. I know it's got a lot of influence, but that influence is not because of strong-arming. That influence is because they're acting like we did in the 1950s. They're saving more money than they spend. They're putting the nation's resources into education. People are hungry and they want to get ahead, and they'll work 24 hours a day. So how can you say they got too much influence? They're just competing. We have to up our game and compete against them. We can't hold them back. What are you going to do, hold China back?
James McGregor's book is called 1 Billion Customers. Mr. McGregor, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Got other questions about global competition? Write us. It's money@marketplace.org. Should you get in on China's housing market or cash out your retirement in China? A mailbag devoted to all your Sino questions coming up. And we hear from a woman who wields a lot of power here in the Middle Kingdom.
Together with my colleagues, we are changing the buying behavior of millions of Chinese.
A Communist Party leader? No, not at all. An online retailer. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal, and this week we are live from Shanghai in the People's Republic of China. Here is the beautiful thing about shopping online. It just doesn't matter where you are. I could go back to my hotel room here in Shanghai, log on, and order myself up pretty much anything I want. Stores like Amazon.com are doing gangbuster business, and that boom isn't confined to the West. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we take a meeting with the CEO of one of China's new online endeavors.
Yeah. 就是说品质上你认为的话就说是不是很可靠。对，就是说外观吧，我觉得特像一垃圾桶。
My name is Peggy Yu Yu. I'm co-president of Dangdang.com, the largest online retailer in China.
我想是他是想时尚。对，他是想时尚。他是想时尚，但是我觉得第一个他装的不够多。
What I find personally satisfying is, together with my colleagues, we are changing the buying behavior of millions of Chinese. That's very fascinating. Online shopping or catalog shopping didn't exist in China 5-6 years ago. And now we are having millions of consumers shopping with us all the time. I enjoy bringing about changes. Then there are dissatisfying part, frustrating part. I remember when Harry Potter was being sold at Dandang, we started a pre-selling, which a lot of people place their order. But then the delivery date gets changed and changed and changed. I think the publisher were trying to have like this simultaneous release time nationwide, and certain goods couldn't arrive certain area at the exact same time. I wish we could do a better job not keeping our readers waiting for Harry Potter Chinese to be released. We got a lot of phone calls. We got a lot of complaints. There are a lot more women CEOs and women professionals from China. If 50 years communism left China one good thing, that's the true belief of equality between genders. Everybody was encouraged to attend school to become a professional. There wasn't such a thing as full-time mom. That didn't exist. I have a 7-year-old, Alexander. I spend several evenings with Xander every week, and I chat with him a little bit, maybe 20 minutes, 30 minutes. But other than that, I have a full-time nanny. Xander is doing most of the growing up by himself. I think that's the way kids should be brought up. I can't do his growing up. I was brought up by working parents, and compared with my parents, I'm devoting more time than my mom did. So I think it's okay with me. I have lots of fun being co-president of Dandang. I tried retirement once before. It was between I was 30 and 31. It wasn't successful. I was bored. Now I'm not thinking of it at all. I think I will work very, very long. And work to me is extension of life.
A Day in the Work Life was reported this week by Nate DeMayo.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, committed to serving Lutherans and their families by helping them achieve financial security and give back to their communities and congregations. Online at thrivent.com. And by Reuters. With fast and accurate information, Reuters helps you stay in the know now. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at nasdfoundation.org.
Home prices dropping like flies bring us this week's Marketplace Money Chinese buzzword, feng chong, or house bug. A house bug is someone who buys apartments as investments. In Shanghai, house bugs are blamed for the city's recent housing bust. The pesky bugs bought low and sold high to folks scrambling to get in on the city's hot real estate market. But the overspeculation has made prices plummet by half in some buildings. Disgruntled buyers are fighting back. Last week, they lined up at one house bug's office and demanded their money back. But the company said no. A rare instance of a bug squashing a man.
It is mailbag time again, but not just any old mailbag today. It is the China edition. I am here in Shanghai all week. We're operating out of the Pujiang Hotel. It is the Astra House Hotel right here in Shanghai. I get to come here. Chris Farrell has to stay home. He is our economics editor and the man with all the answers. Hey, Chris.
Hi, how you doing, Kai? And how do I say good morning in Chinese?
Got a couple of ways, but I'll give you the most basic one, I think. It's Zashanghao.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
That's right. Repeat after me. Zashanghao. All right. If you have a call or a question for Chris Farrell, 800-537-5252 is the phone number. money@marketplace.org gets an email to us. And Chris, let's get right to those emails. Lee writes us from Vancouver, Washington. Here's what he wants to know. He's encouraging his parents to buy a condominium down in Shenzhen. That's a special economic zone down south near Hong Kong and Guangdong province. He says he wants them to buy it for their retirement because he figures, you know, since the cost of living here is so low, that their retirement dollars would go a lot farther. Wants to know your thoughts on China as a place to put your retirement money, to invest, and, you know, just sort of have a little pied-à-terre here, if you will.
Oh, there's a couple of issues here. I mean, it's a really intriguing question and how the world has changed. But China might work as a place for downshifting. So you want to change careers, you want to change jobs, maybe not work so hard. It's not a place for retirement. As far as buying a condo, and boy, Kai, you'd probably know this better than I. You're in the Shanghai boom right now. It's a frontier real estate market there.
Yeah, it actually is. And here's the thing. I mean, there's all kinds of rules and regulations governing, you know, when you can sell, who you can sell to, how long you have to hold your property before you can flip it. And I'll tell you what, Chris, just this past week, while we've been here in Shanghai doing the morning report, there was a news item out about Shanghai property values falling and unhappy real estate investors lining up at developers' offices asking for their money back. It's fraught, shall we say.
Boy, you know, we talk about the real estate bubble here in the United States. Forget about it. It's nothing compared to what's going on with China. So that's another cautionary note that I put out there. And then you mentioned healthcare, and that's really the big issue. There is decent healthcare coverage in China, but it's not great. And the other thing is, if you like certain things that we've grown used to here in this country, well, you can get them in China. I'm sure you can. But you're going to pay for it.
Yeah, you absolutely can. Now, let's get back to that healthcare thing real quick. If you want Western healthcare, A, it can be hard to find if you're not in a major city. And B, it is absolutely going to cost you. So maybe retiring here is perhaps not the thing to do, Lee. I don't know. 800-537-5252 is our phone number. That's the number back home, obviously. It's not going to get you to me here in China. Jeff's on the line from Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Jeff.
Hi.
Tell me, you ever been to China?
No. I've been to Chinatown, but not to China.
All right, well, close enough. Listen, what's on your mind today?
I was concerned, you know, hearing that you're going to China about legal protection for American investors. You know, I just read in the Times about a week ago, Chinese citizens, you know, go to their local, equivalent county court, and they get turned away. What happens if an American company has contracts not honored? Is there any recourse there like it would be, you know, in Western Europe or places?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, first of all, let me just say right off the bat, it's not like doing business in Western Europe or the States. Chris, what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that, yes, the legal system, as you mentioned, I mean, look, it's unreliable. In this country, if you get in a tiff with your supplier, you'll get sued. In China, you could end up in jail, depending on the political connections. And it's a maze, and the regulations are evolving. The good news, and I think this is important, is that there is respect, by and large, for private property. That's increasing. China has joined the World Trade Organization. There are negotiations going on with a number of regulatory bodies like the Securities and Exchange Commission to come up with some harmonious rules and how to treat shareholders and to increase the number of publicly traded companies in China and to make it easier but also better for Chinese companies to participate in our market. So the direction is good, but you really highlighted what is a weakness here. And that is the legal system, the corruption, and the blurring between the lines of enterprise and government.
Now, the question about corruption disturbed me because, you know, back in America here, there's all these corruption trials and everything. Could we still be successful and stay within the American law of not bribing officials or working with bribes and, you know, behaving like a so-called good citizen, but avoid, you know, breaking American laws overseas?
Well, first of all, you have to avoid breaking American laws, because even if you break American laws over here, it's problematical for you in the States. There is a very strong temptation on the part of business people here, the people I talk to, and some of the people that we've talked to for Marketplace's shows next week from China. There is a temptation on the part of American executives here to go with the flow and sort of try to get things done. And to some degree, you have to do that. But people need to be very careful about exactly how they do it, because it is absolutely not risk-free.
Corruption is really the major source of social unrest right now in China. Corruption and upset over corruption really seems to be roiling a lot of citizens around China. And so I think that's a game you have to be very careful to play.
Hope that answered your questions, Jeff.
Yes, it did. Thanks very much.
All righty. Best of luck.
Okay.
The show is in China this week, but we're going to be home in LA next week, and we will need your calls and your emails if we're going to have anything to talk about. Money@marketplace.org gets an email to us. Our phone number is 800-537-5252. Chris, we've got a call coming to us from Patrick in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Patrick.
How you doing?
I'm all right, thanks. Listen, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I work for a company. We do privatized housing for universities.
Excellent. What schools?
One of them is at Towson University, and the other one is at University of Maryland, Baltimore County. So I help work with the managers there.
Great. Now, I understand you're a student yourself?
Yes. I'm in an executive MBA program at Loyola College in Maryland, and we actually are coming to China next fall as part of our coursework.
Oh, very cool. Where are you coming to?
Beijing and Shanghai.
Very good. Let me recommend to you the Astor House Hotel, by the way. It's been doing us very well here.
Does that get you a free meal or something?
Yeah, you do have breakfast. And I have to tell you, the coffee's very good, I must say.
Oh, well, then that's, given the fact they're getting more sleep because of the schoolwork, I'm all for that.
That's right. There you go. Listen, what can we do for you today?
Well, the question I had is I've been taking all these courses, and we've been talking about coming to China. The thing that no one's kind of explained, and it's been when I saw the marketplace stuff coming up for China trip, was how do they balance a communist country, but this whole free market idea, because communism generally talks about, you know, public ownership of private markets, you know, the creation of wealth. It doesn't really tie into what I think is a communist type of government.
Yeah, okay. Let me just tell you that this is in no way, shape, or form a communist country. I mean, I can't imagine. I could walk out my hotel door, and I'll be smack in the middle of downtown Shanghai, and you could be in Hong Kong for all you knew. And all the booming, bustling, incredible capitalism that happens there is happening here, too. Chris, I'll let you explain the economics of the whole thing, but this is just not a communist place.
One of China's best-known economists is Fang Gang. He now believes that about 70% of China's gross domestic product, so 70% of its economy, is now in private hands, which is a remarkable transformation over the past 25 years. So you really have a wide-open capitalist economy, but the politics and the military are still tightly controlled by the Communist Party, a group of people who are holding on to power because they don't want to open up the political system the way that they've opened up the economic system. It's a real tension, and I think one of the big questions that everybody wrestles with is how long can China keep up this situation? And I think another way to put it is, how long can you have this type of capitalist activity, 70% of your economy in private hands, greater ties to the world economy, and not have the political structure crumble?
Chris, if you can answer that question, you know, you're going to win some kind of Nobel Prize, because nobody really knows exactly what's going to happen here. But I'll point out just for a second, Patrick, that yes, there are state-controlled enterprises, and yes, there is a state-run media. But once you get down to the working man and the working woman in this country, it's all about the same thing it's about in the States: finding a job, a better job, a good job, saving for college, saving for the kids, saving for retirement. It's all of the same things on a day-to-day basis here that are happening back in the States. With this weird level of government stuff hanging over you that lets you know that it's just a little tiny bit different somehow.
It just seems like it's going to crash, though, at some point with the politics, because, you know, the money is going to drive it, is it not?
Well, yeah, and, you know, here's the thing. I mean, China's economy has been growing at, Chris, what's the number, 9.5%, 10% a year?
9.5% for 2 decades.
Right.
The question is, how long can that keep up? And the answer is, I don't know, and Chris doesn't know, and nobody knows. Everybody's worried about it. People are thinking about it. It'll have global repercussions when it happens. Will politics be a part of that? Sure. But the truth is, we don't know what we don't know.
One of the fascinating things to watch this year is the state has really dominated the financial system, and it is opening up the financial system to foreign ownership, foreign investors, trying to bring about some more privatization. And it's trying to deal with this, or one reason is just this massive amount of bad loans that are carried on the books of the banks. So this is going to be one of the real tricky transitions that the government has made, but it's a transition, once again, going in the right direction.
Yeah. Hey, Patrick, let me ask you something. You're coming here next fall, right?
Yes.
Okay, here's what I want you to do. That's, what, like 8 months from now. Take my email address with you when you come, and drop me a line when you get here, because I'd be willing to bet that just walking down the street and looking around, your impression will be that this is just in no way, shape, or form a communist or command-controlled economy.
Yeah, I mean, that's where we're coming. We're supposed to meet with some companies and government officials to do a project on emerging markets, because I guess it still is one. But we see these numbers and we see all these statistics, and, you know, you just try to put the math together, because I guess the only example you can think of is the former Soviet Empire.
Right, exactly. Anyway, Patrick, do as I said, will you? And drop me a line.
I will.
No,
I'd be glad to. Once I get over the jet lag, I'll be glad to drop you a line.
Yeah, it's taken me 6 days this time. It's really just not a good time.
Oh, good. We're flying coach. That's great.
All right. Good luck. Enjoy your
trip. Thank
you. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Chris, one last email for us today. It comes from Sheila in San Diego, California. She is interested in investing in China, she writes, but she's curious as to how she can sort of keep an eye on the human rights issue while she's watching her investments.
See, I think this is one of the most fascinating questions in investing today for anyone who, you know, really does think about socially responsible investing, wants to do right with their money. Because there are, if you go to the social responsible sites, SRIWorld.com, for example, there's a lot of information. And I know a number of the companies that you've been profiling, for example, you know, are essentially green companies, the Chinese equivalent of Google, the Chinese equivalent of Amazon.com.
Right.
And these are being plucked out and being put into quote unquote green portfolios. And that's one way to approach it. Another way to approach it, and people have very strong feelings, is, you know what? There's not been anything like this, perhaps in the history of the world, of a nation's wealth growing so rapidly, so fast. In the rise of a middle class, we've never seen the rise of the middle class, such as what we're seeing in China. I would imagine that, when were you last in China? Was it a decade ago?
It was 8.5 years ago. Completely different place, by the way. I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah, and I would imagine on just the consumer level, in terms of cars and just the consumer goods that people have, the real wealth that's being created. And so there are some people who say, look, what's the best thing you can do? You invest in good companies that are doing business in China, and that is helping to create wealth, and that is pulling people out of poverty, and that is creating a middle class, and that will probably bring about some dramatic political changes. And that, if you are concerned about human rights, is the best way to invest your money.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And just the change in 8 years, as you mentioned, I mean, it's literally incredible. I walked off the airplane this time back, and it hits you right away. I mean, like that. I don't doubt for a second it's going to keep on going that way. Yeah, there are problems, absolutely. But the change is coming, no question about it. Chris, that is all the time we have for this week. We are back in L.A. with the program next week, and we do need your calls and your letters. 800-537-5252 is the phone number. money@marketplace.org is the place to send an email. Chris, I'll see you when we get back.
Hey, Kai, this has been wonderful.
Meet the Gao family and their finances. We take a look at one Chinese household taking advantage of today's China. And for tourists in yesterday's China, just getting their hands on some cash was the stuff of suspense thrillers.
Well, it was very cloak and dagger stuff. For sure, in those days, it created a little bit of intrigue.
You are listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal, and we are coming to you live from Shanghai, China. The government here still calls itself communist, but the Chinese economy is now about as capitalist as they come. That is no surprise to people who study this country. They will tell you that Chairman Mao's revolution was an aberration in a culture that has valued commerce for centuries. But if communist ideology is fading here in China, communist imagery doesn't seem to be going anywhere. On the latest installment of The Color of Money, where we look at banknote design from countries around the world, Ruth Kirshner finds the revolution alive and well on the UN.
At a Beijing market, tourists haggle with Chinese traders over fake Gucci bags and fake Rolex watches. 20 years ago, finding a tourist here would have been unthinkable, for a simple reason. Foreigners couldn't have Chinese yuan. The yuan, also known as renminbi or the people's money, was for citizens only.
It was illegal for foreigners to have renminbi, and if you were caught with them, there could be serious circumstances.
Chris Devonshire Ellis is a tax consultant. He's lived in Beijing for years and remembers when getting black market renminbi was a thrill.
Well, it was very cloak and dagger stuff. But yes, for sure, in those days, it created a little bit of intrigue and extra spice. It was kind of fun.
Today, though, foreigners are free to withdraw yuan from ATMs across the country, and they are free to take a close look at what's on them, namely Chairman Mao. Long Live Mao goes this popular song from the 50s, and he does live in paper form. The man who despised capitalism is on every banknote in the country, from the green one yuan note to the red 100. It hasn't always been so. Here at the currency exhibition in Beijing's National Museum, displays tell the story of Chinese money. China was the first country ever to use paper bills, says the exhibition's Wang Jijie.
The oldest paper money in China can be traced back to the Baisong dynasty of the 11th century. In the Sichuan region, people used iron coins, but the iron money was very heavy and not easy to carry, so businessmen invented paper money for their business activities.
The bills still weren't exactly practical. Some of the museum's oldest samples are as big as letter-sized sheets of paper. A few hundred years later, Chinese money, like Chinese politics, had changed. The banknotes were smaller and looked strangely familiar, like US greenbacks. That's because after the Communist Revolution, the Chinese government briefly used an American printing press. But as museum displays like this explain, yuan's quickly developed a distinct identity under communism. Wang says it endures to this day.
All designs from the beginning to the present reflect three things: construction and economic modernization, the unity of the Chinese people, and famous sites such as the Three Gorges and the Lake of Hangzhou.
Note, she didn't mention Mao. Until 1999, in fact, the chairman appeared on just one bill, not alone, but together with other leaders. Most yuans depicted farmers, miners, and demonstrators working to forge a bold future. It wasn't until China embraced capitalism that its most famous communist took center stage on the renminbi. In a time of insecurity, says Li Dong of the Currency Museum, depicting Mao's familiar face made perfect sense.
In China, Chairman Mao is well accepted and probably the least controversial figure. He has played the most important role in the founding of the new China.
So in today's China, Mao is everywhere, in huge quantities. Credit cards are only now coming into fashion. Most transactions are still in cash. Want to buy a car? You'll need a briefcase full of 100 yuan notes. The chairman might spin in his grave if he knew he'd become such a visible symbol of excess. Or perhaps he'd cherish the idea that 30 years after his death, his people still carry him in their hearts, or at least their wallets.
In Beijing, I'm Ruth Kirschner for Marketplace Money.
If you want to see the UN for yourself, you can head to our website. There you'll find some special web-only features from our trip to China, photos, blogs, and slideshows. Click on over to marketplace.org.
Multicolored yuans might be pretty, but getting China to change their value hasn't been. Last year, China slightly loosened the yuan's tie to the U.S. dollar, allowing its exchange rate to float within a margin of 0.3% each trading day. But members of Congress say that's not enough. They want the yuan to fluctuate on its own, and they want China to revalue the currency more quickly. Because right now, the artificially low yuan gives Chinese exporters an unfair trade advantage and leaves them sitting pretty. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans and their Thriven Builds program, where Lutherans volunteer to build decent homes in partnership with families in need in their own communities. Online at thrivenbuilds.com. Marketplace China reports are supported by Best Buy, building a global network to help enrich lives through technology, innovation, and opportunity. Best Buy. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, on the web at kauffman.org.
Dad drives a Passat. Mom buys furniture from Crate and Barrel. And they both spend so much on their daughter that Grandma thinks she is spoiled rotten. Sounds like your typical suburban American family, right? But it is not. The Gaos live here in Shanghai, and they are an example of a relatively new phenomenon in China, the upper middle class. Last week on our sister program, The Marketplace Morning Report, Scott Tong presented a series of profiles about each of the Gaos, but we have him here today to talk about their finances. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Kai.
So you spent some time with the Gao family in Shanghai a couple of months ago. Why don't we, for Marketplace Money listeners who might not have heard the series you did on The Morning Report, why don't we introduce the family?
Sure. Well, it's three people who live in this household. Mom and dad are 30-somethings. They were born in the 60s during China's Cultural Revolution. And now they have become kind of this self-made, successful family. Tango and his wife represent the two big economic engines in China. Tango, the entrepreneur, he runs an advertising firm. And it's all about promoting domestic consumption. And the wife, Isabella, is on the export side. She works for a German shipping company. Now, for China, they are wealthy. They're top 5% for China. So they work very hard. They make a lot of money for China. And when I talked to Tango and I asked him why, one reason is because you just have to compete with your friends. Everybody's keeping score. So let's play a little bit of the Tango tape.
It's a competition because they can treat their daughter, son in very special ways. So you have to compare them because otherwise your daughter will feel unbalanced.
And that again is Tango Gao, the father in that family, 39 years old. The other member of the family is a 7-year-old daughter. She's in first grade. Both parents think she's pretty spoiled. There's new wealth in China. There's the one-child policy. So they get to spend a lot of money on this kid.
They have obviously done really well just in terms of taking advantage of the economic revolution that's happening here. They are winning the game, I guess.
This family, the Gaos, certainly are at the top of the game. Now, economists and historians, they look at it from 30,000 feet, and they talk about all these changes in policy. These changes have affected people like Tango Gao. I talked to Andy Rothman. He's a China analyst in Shanghai with a brokerage firm, CLSA.
Well, 20 years ago, when I first started working here, Mr. Gao would not have been able to own his own apartment, pick his own place of employment, would not have been able to start his own business, would not have been able to own his own car, would not have been able to decide where to send his kid to go to school, and would have had to get the party's permission to get an airplane ticket or get married to his wife. Today, the party basically doesn't want to know what he's up to as long as he doesn't try and create an organization which threatens the party's continued rule.
When the Gao family gets its paycheck every couple of weeks or, you know, at the end of the month, how do they decide what to spend it on? How much do they save? I mean, let's delve into the checkbook here.
Well, every month, take-home pay is about $2,500. Most of it comes from the wife's paycheck, Isabella's, and Tango gives her kind of an allowance of about $1,000.
Even though she makes most of the money.
She does. He has his own pot of his own money. Now, he puts a lot of it into his company, but that happens a lot in China, that where the husband is the entrepreneur. And you add that to these old kind of alpha male rules in China where the husband still kind of has his own money. Now, the wife, Isabella, pays the bills. About $1,000 of that goes toward their mortgage for their condo, which is a very expensive condo in China. They also spend $400 or $500 on the kid. Every day she has a tutor after school, and then she has a piano tutor. On Wednesday she goes to English class, on Sunday she goes to ballet class, so she's kind of the activity machine. And the rest of the money they save, about $600, 25% of their paychecks, they save their money.
But that savings rate sort of applies across the Chinese population, from the very rich like the Gaos, down to people who make far less, right?
Well, that's right. It seems like it's part of the culture, saving money to prepare for the long-term future.
Mm-hmm. Now, Scott, what are they saving for? Are they doing things like saving for retirement and the daughter's college education, you know, like we do?
It's those things. It's education, their retirement. It's also the parents' retirement. Culturally, there is a big emphasis on supporting your parents. So they give a lot of money to each of their folks. And they're saving for medical bills down the road. In China, there's kind of a skeletal healthcare system that the government's put in place. But there's really a sense from everyone I talk to that you're kind of one diagnosis away from a major financial setback. The new China is kind of the do-it-yourself China. Do it yourself to get rich and rely on yourself if you have a major setback.
Marketplace is Scott Tong in Washington. You can hear Scott's series on the Gao family on our website. It is marketplace.org. Scott, thanks a lot.
Okay, Kai, thanks.
You can also see a slideshow and some pictures of the Gao family if you go to our website. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
looks like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It is time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help you sort out what is smart, what is stupid, and what's the straight story. But first, this week, let me set the scene for you for just a second, because I am not where I usually am. I'm on the Bund. It is Shanghai's very famous riverfront, and I am right next to the Huangpu River. And that is why we're doing the straight story today from here, because it is a subject near and dear to Chris Farrell's heart. As I think I've mentioned a couple of times on the program, Chris used to be in the Merchant Marine. Chris, why don't you let us in on what you think is going on here?
Well, Kai, I love the sea. And something I learned as a Merchant Marine is that Filipinos ruled the waves. They make up 20%. That's one-fifth of the world's seamen. Now, I mention this
yes,
because the Chinese would love to take that mantle from the Filipinos. China wants to become the world's maritime power. Why haven't they? English. It's the language of commerce, technology, the internet, and yes, the sea.
Right.
Most Filipinos can speak it, most Chinese can't. Or at least that used to be the case. Now, Kai, I understand that the Chinese have English fever.
They do, actually. And, you know, in Chinese, it's called Yingwen Zhe, which quite literally means English hot.
Well, English should be hot. Here's the straight story. English rules. It's the passport to the global economy. The Chinese are catching on, and that's a good thing.
Well, Chris, maybe you need to explain for me, and it might be obvious, but maybe I'm missing it, the economic benefits of a global language.
Okay. Adam Smith, many years ago, got it right. He said trade and language are two sides of the same process. In other words, if an entrepreneur in Shanghai speaks English and an entrepreneur in Los Angeles speaks English, they can communicate, they can do deals, and you multiply this around the world. But the other thing about speaking English is that as more people learn it, more opportunities open up for them. So if you're living in India, you know English. You can get a job with an offshoring firm working with an American multinational. Same thing in Malaysia or in Poland. So what this really is, the language of science, technology, and engineering, it's opening up to the mass of people opportunities anywhere in this global economy.
All right, Chris, let me do this, though. There's a crowd of people standing around watching me do this part of the broadcast, and I'm going to bring one of them in here now. I'm going to ask him a very simple question in Chinese. Okay. So it's a guy trying to sell me a Rolex watch, and he cannot speak English. I guess there's probably half a dozen people here. I mean, I'd be willing to bet if I asked them, they wouldn't be able to speak English either. So my question is, if the elites in this country can speak English, what good does that do if the common man can't?
All right. It's partially generational, because now English is being required in the lower grades. But let me give you a number that also addresses your issue.
Sure.
In Asia, there are about 350 million speakers of English. Now, that is larger than the population of the U.S., Canada, and Britain combined.
Huh.
And that's going to widen. In Beijing, cab drivers are being handed out by the government tapes so that they can at least learn the basics of English. So when there are the Olympics and people want to go to a restaurant, the cab drivers are conversant.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, I was in Beijing a month ago, and if I hadn't been able to speak Chinese, I'd have been in a world of hurt, because they're not doing so well with that English program up there.
Well, this is a process.
Yeah, well, exactly, right. They've started, and they've still got, you know, a couple of years to the Olympics. Let me ask you something, though. What do I say when my kids start language classes in school, and they say, Dad, why do I have to learn French or Spanish? I mean, if everybody's going to learn English, like Chris Farrell says, why should I bother?
Oh, that's the wrong lesson. The wrong lesson from the trend. Yes, the world is going bilingual. But let's say you want to do deals in China, you'll be able to talk to a lot of people who know English, but they'll respect you a lot more.
Right.
And you'll learn more if you also know Chinese.
All right, the polyglot straight story from our man Chris Farrell. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Kai, and enjoy the waterfront.
Zaijian. Before we go this week, let me tell you a little story. Back in the 90s, I lived in China for a couple of years, up in Beijing, in a nice little neighborhood that was just then starting to have cafes and bars and places that expats would want to hang out. One day, my wife and I were walking down to the market, and we passed the corner branch of the Bank of China, and we saw these three guys, clearly migrant workers, pull up on their bicycles. They pulled out some pickaxes and started whacking away at the side of the building, really just wailing away on it. Well, maybe we'd become jaded by that time, but we just kind of shrugged and said, all right, whatever. Because in all honesty, every day in China, you see something that makes you say, wow, look at that. Anyway, about 3 days later, we were walking past that same corner, and we noticed the Bank of China has a brand new ATM installed via pickaxe from the outside. It's a true story. Today in Beijing, and here in Shanghai, and in cities all over this country, you can get cash almost wherever you need it. And it's not just you and me, Westerners, but the Chinese, too, because they have more money now than they ever had in their lives. They just have to figure out what to do with it. That is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time on the program, hard-hitting reportage on cheapskates.
The better the car was, the lower the tip was. And the crummier the car was, the better the tip was.
Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes with Rico Galliano, Nancy Fargali, James Richter, April Lunston, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. This week, special thanks to Deborah Clark, Julie Small, Nate DeMeo, Brett Neely, Eric Johnson, and Michael DeMarc. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, no matter where you are, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you next week back in L.A.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need, when you need it, is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplacemoney.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, serving Lutherans, their families, and communities by helping them achieve financial security and give back to their communities and congregations, offering a wide range of financial products and services. Thrivent.com.
That's
American Public Media, by the way.